House Civil Law Committee will come to order. Chair recognizes the quorum. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 4th, 2014? Representative Yaruso moves the minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. First bill on the agenda. Hey, can I have some quiet in the back of the room?
They didn't hear you.
Thank you. First bill up on the agenda is House File 2176. And
seven.
Yeah, that too. House File 2167 is up. And Mr. Anfinson, would you come forward? And I am just going to present from the chair. There's an author's delete all amendment to House File 2167, the DE1. Chair moves that amendment in order to get the bill in the form that I desire. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, then all in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. I would note, members, that this bill as amended passed through the Senate unanimously yesterday. I'm not sure if that's a good thing for the bill or a bad thing, but nonetheless, it should color the conversation. Members, we have Mr. Mark Anfinson here today to testify on the bill. And Mr. Anfinson, maybe you can give a little bit brief history about how this bill came before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. We support this bill and appreciate the chair's authorship of it because it is an important issue. It also involves a fairly simple approach to what is a complex statute. And the statute is Minnesota Statute Section 13.05 Subdivision 11, which was enacted back in 1999. And for many years kind of slumbered without a lot of attention. The key provision of this statute is the following. If a government agency enters into a contract with a private party, then all of the data collected by the contractor in performing the contract is subject to the requirements of the Data Practices Act. Okay? So the private contractor contract performance data comes within the scope of the Data Practices Act. The main reason that law was enacted in 1999 was very simple. There was a recognition that an increasing number of government contracts transferred to private parties highly sensitive government data, private data about individuals and things like that. And so the legislature decided there should be some mechanism to protect the security and privacy of a lot of that data in private hands. There was also a concern that public access could be blocked to important government contracting information if it was held only by the contractor and never provided to the agency, which does happen. So this law was enacted to achieve those two important goals. It included a provision that said the contract that is entered into with the private contractor and the government agency shall include a notice making clear that the terms of the statute, the requirements of the Data Practices Act, apply to the contract data. Okay, so over the next 13 or 14 years, there were probably 10 opinions issued by the Information Policy Analysis Division of the state saying that even if you fail to include in your contract that notice that the statute applied, it still applied. The IPAD held that had to be inferred into the contract. It didn't make sense otherwise. A couple of Court of Appeals decisions over the years held the same thing. However, that all changed last fall when the Supreme Court, in a case that dealt directly with this statute and a contract between Johnson Controls and a school district in St. Louis County for the large school construction project, that contract did not contain the notice that I just described. Johnson Controls refused to provide certain information requested by my client, a small newspaper in St. Louis County, The case rumbled on through the litigation system for about 3 years, and the Supreme Court held last November that if the contract did not include this notice, the contract was not subject to the law at all. So overnight, 13 or 14 years of settled law that everybody understood worked in a certain way was upended. And two categories, I know that rarely happens with the Supreme Court and legislative intent, but this is one of those rare cases. So in any event, overnight you ended up with two classes of government contracts. One class where you have the notice in them. If the parties do what the law says they're supposed to do and put the notice in, it's covered by the Data Practices Act. Another class of contracts where the parties don't put the notice in and fail to abide by the law are exempt. And so the consequence here can be fairly dramatic. You lose complete public access to government contract performance data in some cases because of that ruling. That's bad from our perspective, and that's mainly why we're here. But I emphasize you also lose control of highly sensitive private data held by private contractors. I'll give you two quick examples. A parent has some issues with her child's bus driver in the school district, public school district. And the bus driver is actually employed by a private contractor as a contract with the district, a common situation around the state. The student goes to the district and says, I want to know who my student's bus driver is. And the district says, we either don't know or can't tell you. Why can't they? Because it's the bus company's data. And then the parent goes to the bus company and says, I'd like to know who my student's bus driver is. They don't have to tell her if this law doesn't apply. If it does, they do. That's a simple example. A much more significant and common example is where you have, for example, IT vendors doing website work for government agencies. They will often, again, even school districts in particular, obtain access to or actually maintain and store large amounts of highly private sensitive data. Without this statute applicable, there's a real question as to whether they have a duty under state law to protect the privacy and security of that data. So what this amendment would do is very simple with that background. And that is to say clearly what everybody understood the law was until November 2013, which is that even if a contract does not include the statutory notice, it is still subject to the requirements of this statute. Thank you. I've said enough. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, he's saying everyone understood this before. So am I understanding correctly that this also applies so that in the example you gave where the school district contracts with the bus company, that when the bus company agrees to that contract, it's agreeing to release any data that it collects or has to the school district. So this really goes both ways. And my question is, A, am I understanding that properly? And B, is that something that everyone understood? So every private contractor has understood up to this point that they have to release their data to the government? Or is it just the government's data that had to be handled the way the government would have handled?
Mr. Ampson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, as I said, it's a fairly simple amendment. It's a pretty complex statute, and that's one of the issues that has come up. How the law has operated until last November was that if you have a contract, as you describe, the contractor doesn't have to necessarily give anything to the school district, to the government agency. That's not how this statute works. What the statute really said and has done is to do this. If the district doesn't have particular data from the contractor, I can go to the bus company and ask for that data directly if it's related to the performance of the contract and if it's public data. Again, the bigger issue is that bus company is also obligated under the terms of this statute to protect from disclosure private data, such as the names, conditions, information about the students that they transport. But there's no duty in this statute as such to transfer data from the contractor to the government agency. It one other quick point. If that data is given to the school district, in many cases it might be or would be, or some of it, then as a member of the public, I have to go first to the school district to ask for it. Only if the district doesn't have it do I go to the contractor. So I hope I answered your question.
Other questions for Mr. Amundson? Seeing none, then, Chair, well, is there anyone from the public who wants to testify on this? If there is, please come down. Oh, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to belabor this, but frankly, it's kind of clear as mud to me. And I don't know if there are other testifiers, I can wait until they have testified on this, but I'm still not entirely clear because, you know, I started out, and I haven't listened to this before, so I'm just hearing this for the first time, but I understand that what we're doing here with the bill is just clarifying something, basically fixing something the court broke, which we've had to do that before. No problem there.
I'm but aware that you have, yeah.
So,
well, to be fair, the court claims that we broke it.
Yeah, okay.
Well, it was not a brilliantly drafted statute. I will concede that. It was clear as mud, as you say. There was some guesswork involved.
Representative Liebling?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. But since we're now going to make an attempt to clarify and do something new, what I need, so you start out saying everyone understood certain things, and this is bringing us back to what everyone understood. I don't understand it. So I think I'm hearing there are really four elements to this. I think you could maybe think of it, if I'm right, you know, correct me if I'm totally in the mud here, but so you've got two entities, the government and the private entity, and then you've got two different issues. One is what the government, how the private has to deal with the government data and how the government has to deal with the private party's data, right?
Correct.
Mr. Amundson.
I'm sorry, Matt, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, correct.
Right. And so does this keep in place everybody's understanding of those relationships that there is currently, or that there was previous to the what the court did? Did everyone already understood what this bill is doing on all of those dimensions? Can we kind of break it down that way?
Mr. Amundson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I believe they did. I am not going to sit before this committee and guarantee that everyone understood something. I mean, here's why I say that everyone understood. I'll give you the reason. Because, as I say, there were about 10 advisory opinions issued by the Information Policy Analysis Division starting in 2001, not long after the law was enacted, that consistently stated that even if a government contract does not include this notice, it's still subject to the law. That's number one. Then there was a Court of Appeals decision as early as 2003 that held the same thing. And so there was never any legal decision to the contrary. So over that period of 13 or 14 years, that's why I say everyone, that's how it worked. That's how it was done. All state contracts, for example, have the official state contracting procurement form has long included this notice in it consistently. Virtually every state contract does have that in it because of this common understanding. So it's my firm belief that what you've described, the different types of data exchanges, all were quite clear and quite settled among the contractors and the agencies. At the table, I would indicate is Ms. Lori Beyer-Kaprensky, who's the head of the Information Policy and Analysis Division of the State Department of Administration, who's also wonderfully familiar with this complex law.
So okay. She can answer questions. And thank you. Ms. Beyer-Kaprensky, if you had a statement to make, go ahead. Otherwise, Representative Howell has a question, and it's Chair's intent to vote on this.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to be able to respond to Representative Liebling's question just as to the information that is in state contracts and grants and the kind of notice that vendors were receiving and whether or not if someone read their contract would understand this. I was just going to read one line out of the paragraph. As it applies to all data collected, created, received, stored, used, maintained, or disseminated by the grantee under this grant contract is subject to the Act. I know many vendors and grantees don't read their contracts very fully or didn't understand that, but I think that's about as clear a notice as people could provide.
Thank you. Representative Howell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is why wouldn't, if it's standard or required to have that notice in there, wouldn't the contract then be null and void if it didn't have that contract language in there?
Mr. Evanson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howe, that's actually a good question. That came up a bit in the litigation that I was involved in. That's a fair issue, but everybody kind of ducked it, I think, because no one wants to invalidate these contracts. They simply want them to operate in a rational way. I should point out, by the way, Mr. Chair, that we have circulated the original bill and the delete everything widely among all of the parties that seem to have an interest in this issue, including all the local government representatives and various private groups. And there's a spectrum of reaction to it, somewhere between neutral and concern, and we can continue to work with those groups. But I think the concern part on the spectrum focuses much more on the underlying statute, which again has been in place since 1999, and not on the delete everything amendment language, which again really does, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but restores the law to what everybody thought it was until November.
Representative Scott.
I just wanted to add that I do have a bill to make them null and void, but I didn't get a hearing, so.
Yeah, sorry, Representative Scott.
Yeah.
I'll get you back on another.
A little road of bitterness just going on, just okay. Some saying.
Understood. Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, then I have moved that this House File 2167, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
So where did Deb go? Okay. No.
All right, Representative Lesh, do you move to re-refer House File 2385 to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy?
I do, Madam Chair, and I have no amendments.
All right, to your testifiers, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Chris Meserly, Melissa Milberg-Wendland, who's here to testify.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
My name is Melissa Milberg-Wendland, and my colleague Chris Meserly is also here, but he's up in the audience. He knows that I can just take care of it. I am a resident of Arden Hills. I live there with my husband and three children. I am an attorney at Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Cerisi. I have been there for 9 years, and I primarily practice in medical malpractice. And the bill that I'm here to testify about today is House File 2385. And it's about expert affidavits in professional negligence cases. So in looking at the bill, there's two statutes to be amended. The first statute is 145.682 that deals with professional negligence medical malpractice, so hospitals, doctors, nurses. The other statute is dealing with all other professional negligence, which is going to be attorneys, CPAs, architects, engineers, land surveyors, and the like. And I'll give you a very brief background on those statutes and then how those were affected by the Supreme Court last year when they made amendments to the civil rules, and then discuss the amendments. The statutes in question were enacted in 1986, and there were some changes along the way, but I'll discuss how one of those enacted the 180-day deadline hasn't changed. In medical negligence cases, you cannot file a lawsuit in Minnesota State Court unless you talk to an expert. And then also there's another expert affidavit that's required. So after you start the lawsuit, which in Minnesota is when you actually serve the summons and complaint on a defendant, you have 180 days to gather information, take depositions, answer written questions, and also exchange documents in a time period we call discovery. At that 180 days, you give all that information to your expert, and they give a fair and honest evaluation of the case. And you have to send that to the other side. And again, in 1986, the legislature determined that 180 days is a fair and reasonable amount of time to gather that information to get it to your expert. On July 1st, 2013, the Minnesota Supreme Court enacted some amendments to the civil rules. The Supreme Court created a task force, and that task force ended up looking for ways to try to make Minnesota civil system more efficient. And one of the ways that they did that in a rule that the Supreme Court adopted is that they determined that you cannot exchange information right away in the case. It used to be that this time frame called discovery was open at the beginning, right when you serve that summons and complaint. The Supreme Court determined that no party can seek any information from any source, in or outside the lawsuit, until the parties have met and conferred and agreed upon a discovery plan. And that the purpose and why the Supreme Court adopted that is to basically judicial efficiency, keep the court out of it. So essentially, the court wants parties not to exchange information, but actually have a conversation and say, here's how we're going to exchange things, here's what we need, and come up with a schedule. So basically, they won't have to involve the court. So it's less court time. And what the Supreme Court did is that they inadvertently did not cross-reference these two statutes. Reason being is that we had the 180 days at the beginning, from right when you commence the lawsuit, 180 days, and now the Supreme Court has made a rule that has cut down that time frame, basically saying you cannot exchange information. So what this amendment is doing is merely conforming these two statutes, because the Supreme Court didn't cross-reference them, and return that time frame, 180 days, just back to the status quo. This won't delay lawsuits. This won't cause any extra costs. This is merely conforming and bringing back the law to the status quo as it was since 1986. I'd appreciate your support in House File 2385, and I'm certainly willing to take any questions if anyone has any.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lesh?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 2385 be re-referred to Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lesh. We take Fisher next. Is Representative Fisher here? Could you represent Clark? Representative Clark? But there's an amendment. Welcome to the committee. Members, just for your information, this bill actually passed this committee, was sent to the General Register, and then it came back because it was not enacted during the last legislative session. And there is an author amendment, but it just merely changes the effective date. So the chair would move that House File 300 be re-referred to the General Register, and then Representative Clark, I will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you would like it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions from members? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Just on the amendment. Motion prevails. All right. Representative Clark, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this bill did pass this committee last year, and we didn't get to it on the House floor, so it's back here due to House rules. And just to remind you what the bill does, it does require a landlord to provide a tenant a notice 7 days before they file an eviction order if they fail to pay rent. And the purpose of this is to give that, make sure that in every case, a tenant has the opportunity to try to get the resources together to actually pay up and be able to continue to stay in the property. And I have a witness, Madam Chair, I'd like to just talk a little bit more about some research that he's done on this bill, that's more current even than the last time we were here, so that's okay.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Please go ahead and please be brief.
I shall. Madam Chair, my name is Paul Bernberg. I'm the senior housing attorney at Homeline, and given that this is deja vu all over again, I'm just highlight a couple points and then give a couple new pieces of information I've gathered since we appeared last time. First, the bill requires a 7-day notice, written but not notarized. It can just be on scratch paper like this if the landlord's got decent handwriting. The provision for a quit or pay notice, there are more than 40 other states that require it, so this is hardly some kind of brand new thing. As Representative Clark said, it triggers the right to get emergency assistance or help from a church, or it will motivate tenants to go after their own resources. It'll save emergency assistance money because they're spending about a third of their money now in court costs because they're waiting for an eviction action to be filed in many cases. And it's going to cut down the number of UDs on tenants' records, eviction actions, which really screw up a tenant's record. There were a couple concerns that were posed by one by a member of this committee and one by another representative, and they seemed like reasonable questions. One of the questions was, if most landlords, and I think it's true, if most landlords actually give some sort of notice now, what's the need for this? And so what I did is I went to the Hennepin County courthouse, where you can look up cases on the computer, and looked up 160 cases. That was 10% of the cases from 2 months, August and September, which was I picked months where there weren't holidays to screw up, or big holidays to screw up the timing, to see when landlords filed cases. It's true most landlords don't like jump the gun and immediately file a case, but 6% of the cases were filed by landlords where the tenant owed less than a month of rent. And another 11% of the cases were filed on the 8th of the month or earlier. So in other words, there's 17% of the cases that were filed so early that, I mean, it'd be earlier than even a 7-day informal notice would occur. That's 1 in 6 cases. So while most landlords do the sensible and right thing and give some sort of dunning notice, maybe not exactly in this form, but something like it, 1 out of 6 don't. There is a need, as Representative Less said, to deal with, as most statutes do, they deal with an aberrant landlord, not the, you know, most landlords don't lock tenants out, but we have a law against it. A second question that came up was, aren't landlords going to say, I got to give a 7-day notice? Well, geez, I'll give it on the 2nd of the month. It's not paid by the 9th. I'm going to rush out there and file on the 10th. So it's actually going to speed things up. It's a legitimate kind of the unintended consequences question. I didn't think that was right, but you know, no. I did two things. One, I reached out to colleagues on a listserv from other states which have quit or pay notices. I heard back from 7 states to see if there was a clustering of cases as soon as possible. In six of those 7 states, there was no such clustering. Cases were filed all over the place. In the 7th, Oregon, there was some clustering, although they've got an odd notice, which is a 3-day notice, but not given until the 8th of the month. So basically, the vast majority of states that I've heard from, you don't see that clustering. The unintended consequence doesn't occur. The second thing I did is I looked at Minnesota cases, because we do have some landlords here who now have to give a quit or pay notice. They're federally regulated landlords, public housing, project-based Section 8. Public housing needs to give a 14-day notice, so I was looking at whether or not there'd be a pile of cases in the period from the 17th to the 22nd, kind of the 6 days right as soon as they could. If, in fact, there was this unintended consequence, what you would see is many more than 20% of the cases filed in that period. In fact, there were less than 20%, only 12%. Similar results in the project-based housing. In short, the unintended consequences that theoretically occur don't occur in the real world. I thank you.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand you did this court search, yes, this search of files. You came up with 6%, less than 6%, or around 6%, owed less than a month's worth of rent. But that may be for that current, I mean, that's not giving the full story of what may be going on between the relationship between the tenant and the owner. I have seen many cases. I've been a landlord for several years, and I've seen where month after month after month, it's a game of paying strategically just to elongate the process, and there comes a certain point where the landlord is tired of babysitting the whole issue, and so maybe they owe less. Maybe these cases that you found, they owed less than a month of rent, but that could be deceiving in that it's not telling the whole story of the previous several months. And this bill, I see it as just another way for tenants to stretch out the eviction process. So as we said before, most landlords are already gracious. They don't want people to leave. It's a loss for them. But they already are working things out as best they can, giving notice to these tenants. I think this is an unnecessary bill.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is it looks like they have the option twice during a 12-month period to prevent the eviction. They can do that twice a year or more if they pay the reasonable attorney fees. But my question is who tracks that? Who's going to track that twice a year to keep it from going to three times a year, four times a year? Is this the a requirement on a landlord to track that, or what mechanism is there to research that to find out this data?
Who would like that question?
I'll answer.
Go ahead.
The representative and chairwoman. I mean, the landlord would track it because the landlord will know. The landlord's keeping a ledger. If it ends up in court, that part of the case is going to take 1 minute. The landlord's going to have records of whether or not the tenant exerted this right more than two times, and if so, they'll have had to. The tenant's either going to be able to prove that he paid the attorney fees, or he's going to lose that right. I mean, I don't.
So is it,
practically speaking, I really don't. But I think that's the answer to your question.
Representative Howe.
Is that data that landlord holds? Is that going to be private? Is that public? If I'm the next landlord where this tenant is going to go to, I can go back. I can find out where that tenant last was, request that data, but he's done this numerous times, and I can receive that data from the previous landlord. Is that open? Is that public or is that private? How is that data held?
Mr. Bernberg.
Representative Bernberg. And Chairwoman. I mean, it's not private data, and in fact, under current practice, prospective landlords regularly receive from prior landlords all sorts of information about the rent-paying history of the prior tenant. So that would just continue to be. That's happening right now. I'll also add that this, on the issue of the procedure, this language about the two times and three times is taken essentially verbatim from the current law for mobile home tenancies where there's a very similar right. And so that seems to pose no problem in the mobile home context.
Further questions? Follow-up? Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, no, I don't track these issues that closely. You know, I don't have any. I'm not a landlord. I've got relatives who are landlords. But I've been a tenant, you know. And I think that kind of going back to what was mentioned before about how this stuff can be a pain in the neck for the landlord, you know? I mean, there's no question that when you're a landlord, it's a business. And even if you're, like my son has a home that he bought to live in, but now he's moved out of it, he's renting it. So, you know, this is, but nevertheless, you're a person who's essentially earning income off of somebody else's need to have a place to live, which is all fine. But when we talk about the relative issues here, and we're trying to think about who's in this group and what sorts of situations does it cover, and what is the balance here that should be struck? And it seems to me that what you've got on the one side, a person who may be very sincere and, you know, very wants to be a good landlord and, you know, has property that they aren't living in even in the smallest situation and just want to make some money and keep that going. But on the other side, you have somebody who's needs a place to live. And when you look at just what the balances are here and how do we want to err, you know, we're never going to strike a perfect balance. That's going to work perfectly in every situation. That's what we have courts for. But you're talking about somebody whose home is at stake here, who needs a roof over their head, who's going to have their life upended if they, you know, different kinds of things happen, versus somebody who is going to be maybe inconvenienced, as was mentioned, and is going to have to deal with some, you know, difficulties, and it's a pain in the neck. But hey, when you rent property, you hope you don't have that. You hope you have an ideal tenant who's going to just take care of things, and you're not going to have to do anything. But I think the balance here is clearly on the side that we should give a little more latitude toward the tenant, because the differences in what's going on here on the two sides are just, it's not an equal balance. It's not like having two business people having a dispute. This is where, you know, the stakes are really high on one side and not so high really on the other side. So that's kind of how I listen to this, and I think this is a good bill. I think it strikes a good balance, and I think it'll make the system better, maybe even keep some cases out of court. And as the testifier mentioned, give people an opportunity to get their act together and get some help that they may need in a lot of cases. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And I failed to ask, is there anyone in the audience who wanted to testify for or against this bill? Okay, Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was one of the people who raised issues about this bill last year because it sounds like a good idea, but I was concerned about the unintended consequences of a landlord who maybe had a grace period and some flexibility, and that this may actually accelerate the process of evicting somebody. And I appreciate that you did the research and came back and let us know that that unintended consequence isn't something we have to be worried about. Thank you.
Thank you. I take those as needing no reply.
Thank you. Other questions from member? All right. The chair renews her motion that House File 300 be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
A division is called for. All those in favor signify by saying aye. All those opposed? The motion prevails 8-7.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Is Representative Fisher in the room?
No, I have a sick kid.
Representative Fisher, welcome to the committee. Members, I want to make it really clear that there is a clone bill of Representative Fisher's bill. It's also being heard currently. It's currently being heard in Environment and Natural Resources, and that clone bill will be sent to the Judiciary Committee. So the sole purpose of this committee is to hear the administrative penalty provisions. So, Representative Fisher, I'd like you to give us a little bit of background so we understand the context of it, but please make sure that you're focusing on the pieces that are in the jurisdiction of this committee. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee. Okay.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you. Again, we had this discussion before about whether or not there were changes to the amount of penalty, et cetera, and the forcing the Civil Law Committee to act before it's actually gone through the Policy Committee. So I'm just curious, in this clone bill, is it exactly the same, or are amendments to the penalty portion of this bill subject to amendment that we're not aware of?
Representative Fisher.
Okay. As of right now, the clone bills that I have out there are mirroring this exactly. And the one thing I will clarify, and I may have miscommunicated when I was putting forth on the clone bills, the clone bills I have going out there are going to be hitting judiciary and for government ops. This bill will be coming straight to the Environmental Natural Policy Commission Committee after we're done with this stop here. So I apologize for the miscommunication. I do have clones, but it's because I'm trying to hit a number of committees at one time, and that's where I was getting clones going. So this will be this bill here. I'm still asking to have it referred to the the Environmental Natural Resource Policy Committee. And in terms of the narrowness of it, we want to make sure that we have the administrative hearing process in place, and this is to address sections that are already in provision within the current law. This section here is covering, allows the penalties to be administered to sections 103G.255 to 103G.298. And so there's a lot of those provisions in there that this would apply to that are already currently standing in law. This is a request that has been put forward by the DNR. This was a request to, in a response to a report that the Environmental Natural Resource Committee has asked from the DNR, asking what are the additional tools that they need to be more effective in being able to implement and enforce what they're doing out in water management areas and with addressing some of the problems they've had with trying to follow up with people who've been repeated chronic violators of their permits that they have out there because they're finding the current tools are not able to do the job.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Follow-up, Representative Holberg.
Thank you. If I might, my question wasn't answered relative to amendments and the fee and penalty structure. Are you having any discussions with anybody? Should the Civil Law Committee assume that the level of penalty and fees that is in this bill is solid and you're not going to entertain any amendments to those numbers, or might we see them change?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Holberg. What we're trying to do is mirror what the administrative hearing fines that are used by the MPCA and the Department of Health. So if it turns out that they were at a different rate, we might, because from my understanding, they're at a maximum $10,000. This is asking for a maximum of $20,000. So if there was some concerns along those lines, I would be open to amendments to try to make sure that we have some consistency along those lines. Also, I'm also open to trying to tighten up the language here, so if people are feeling that what we have in here does not properly, to their comfort level, make it comfortable for them to feel that this is just for people who have been very chronic abusers, we're open to doing some amendments to try to tighten that up, and we've been having some discussions along those lines. So it'll be something more trying to address some of the concerns that I've been hearing coming from people as we're going through the process. And so that's why I can't guarantee it's going to be the same, because if I can find ways to make this better, I want to do that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I have Representative Scott next. Representative Scott.
Well, I don't know if you're going to have the testifiers go first. My question was related to Representative Holberg's, but I will have follow-up questions. So if you want to have the testifiers, go ahead.
Thank you. Newman? Newberger. Then Newman.
Sorry. I've been called worse. That's okay.
Newberger, sorry. Sorry.
Not okay. A problem. All right. Madam Chair, just a brief clarification. What is the House file number for the clone bill? Do you have that?
Representative Fisher.
I don't have the numbers yet. We're hoping to drop them in the hopper today and have them introduced in tomorrow's session. And at that point, I'll have the bill numbers at that point.
Thank you. All right. To your testifier, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Julie Ekman, and I'm a section manager at the Department of Natural Resources in the Ecological and Water Resources Division. Do you want me to just...
Please continue. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The reason that the department needs administrative penalty order authority is that we need to achieve better compliance with state water use laws. We are trying to work towards our ultimate goal of water sustainability, and we're finding that the tools we have, there's a gap. We have the more egregious, the more repeat offenders, and we don't have an effective tool to bring those people into compliance with state law. We're finding that illegal water use is a growing concern in Minnesota, and tracking them down is a heavy workload for the DNR, and we accrue costs that are not then recuperated through the current process and tools that we have. Through the administrative penalty order authority, we will be enabled to follow a civil process to force compliance with state water use laws. It will give us the ability to levy steep penalties against the most egregious and chronic violators, and we're hoping that that would act as a strong incentive to come into compliance. It would also bring relief to the DNR for the costs that we incur for compliance research and our enforcement work. Some of the major elements of the APA program is that it will allow us to increase enforcement to address the water use violations. Actually, these are some of the things that we have been doing to address our concerns. We have, over the past year or so, increased enforcement to address water use violations. We've also increased our efforts to identify non-compliant water users. And we have begun work in three groundwater management areas around the state where we have specific concerns about the water use. And we have recently launched our online permitting system, Minnesota DNR Permitting and Reporting System. That's called MPARS for the acronym. And this is improving water use reporting efficiency, and it simplifies fee payment. But even with all of these tools, we still have a gap where we don't have the ability to address the worst offenders out there, those that kind of thumb their noses at the DNR because they make a profit from using groundwater, and their profit is so great that for them the current fine system is just the cost of doing business. And those are the people that we really need this tool for, is to bring those people into compliance. And with that, I'm willing to answer any questions.
Questions from members? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you say those violators, how many in number are those per year? Can you give me an average of give the committee an average of how many violators you have out there of this type?
I'm sorry. Could you please repeat your name? I missed it.
Julie Ekman.
Julie Ekman. Ms. Ekman, go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did some compliance research over the past year, and we found. We focused on irrigators because it was easy to do. You can look at aerial photos and see where irrigation is occurring, and then we can follow up by finding if there are permits there. We found that there was up to about 10% of folks that did not have a permit. But what we did was we followed up with them. We contacted them, and we worked with them, and 9 out of 10 people came into compliance, and that's our goal. You know, we're not really interested in hitting people over the head. We want to bring them into compliance so that we can get the water use information from them so that we can better manage the water resources for the state. So the egregious violators, there's maybe just a handful out there, Representative Howe. I hope the number is very small. I mean, it would be ideal if we really never even had to use this authority, but it is a gap, and when we need it, we believe it could be more effective.
Representative Howe, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ekman, what is the average time frame? I know you just launched the online piece, but what's the average time frame for those farmers that are running, that want to put in an irrigator, or have in the old system, they put in an irrigator system, and now have been requested that appropriation? What is about the time that they have for the DNR to respond to their permit request?
Ms. Ekman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the time frame that it takes to actually go through the permit process depends on a lot of things. It depends on whether or not we need more information from the applicant. In some areas, we need them to run an aquifer test so that we can find out what the impacts are going to be on the aquifer and surface waters. So that could extend how long it takes. It depends on what time of year they apply. This time of year, of course, we get a lot of applications because we're approaching irrigation season, and we can only work so fast and work in so many aquifer test analyses. We still have that goal on the books of 150 days that we're usually way faster than that. You know, 60 to 90 days is our kind of historical goal for working through a permit process.
Follow up, Representative Howe.
Thank you. Well, that being said, of the goal of 150 days, I've got two unpermitted irrigators that have put in wells that have been sitting there for over 6 months. They applied last June and July, that are still waiting for a call back from the folks that they put it. So, and what I struggle with, they put $100,000 into those irrigation systems and don't have any appropriation yet, and they're coming on to the growing season and are very frustrated. I just talked to them yesterday. But that being said, you've got some issues with the number of permits coming in. But so right now the way it looks is you're focusing on the easy folks that are out there that are the farmers and the irrigators. Aren't there other folks out there, such as large aggregate folks that are doing wash stations for their gravel pits. They're doing wash stations there. I know that they've got wells up to 12 inches. Are they an easy pick, or do you have permits for those folks too? How do you plan to go out there and find the non-irrigators? How are you planning to bring those into compliance and actually locate those folks?
Ms. Ekman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is an issue and something that we are working on. Through our groundwater management area processes, we do a more intense investigation of water use in an area. And for example, we have a groundwater management area in the north and east metro area, and it's hardly any irrigation going on there. But through that intense resource, putting those resources into an area, we can seek out who is violating. And it is a little harder because it can be hidden. Sometimes it's word of mouth, and that's something that we're still working on, and of course we need to get there. We're not, you know, intentionally focusing on farmers for this. This administrative penalty order would apply to any egregious repeat violator, not just irrigators.
Any more? Okay. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to need some help with this. I'm trying to come at this, trying to understand how this all kind of works within the construct of the state of Minnesota. In your sheet here, it says illegal water use is a growing concern, and the state tracking down illegal operators creates a heavy workload. So there's a definite concern on the DNR's part here for water permitting and for staff and conservation. Skip to the bottom of the paragraph. It says, this seems to be the primary motivator for your department. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the investigating and proving of such crimes is extremely time-consuming and often results in minimal fines to the operator, so forth and so on. That being read, as I look at the bill here, the question that I would like to have answered here in section 1.11, subdivision 1, investigations, it says if the commissioner determines that an investigation is in the public interest, the commissioner may investigate and monitor activities being conducted with or without a permit that may affect waters of the state. That sentence, I'm having some issues with that sentence and the way that this sets the tone for this bill. First and foremost, it says if the commissioner. How is that determined? How does the commissioner determine that an investigation is warranted? And it says here that, as we continue through the sentence, the commissioner may investigate and monitor activities. These activities are on private property. So I'm really trying to get my head around how this all lines up here. It would appear that we have a guilty until proven innocent type of approach to this. We all took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States and the state of Minnesota. And if I'm just an average guy with a bachelor's degree, so I can read, Article 1 in our Bill of Rights, Section 10, says, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall be issued upon probable cause supported by the oath of affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Now, I understand there's no seizure taking place here, but apparently there is a search that's taking place. So let's go back to the very first word of this bill. If the commissioner determines an investigation is in the public interest, how do we get around this guilty until proven innocent approach, or correct me if I'm wrong, but these don't seem to line up.
If I might, actually, much of that is current law. It's not a change, and that is the policy pieces. We're really here focusing on the administrative penalties, and those places will come through judiciary as well. So I'm going to ask you to be very narrow in any answer that you might give, considering that much of that is current law.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, As the chair pointed out, this is existing law, and the reason for the change is that someone who has a permit may be violating the law too. They may be violating their permit. So this is simply to point out that whether or not someone has a permit, if they're violating the law, then our conservation officers should be able to investigate that.
Madam Chair, thank you for your response. And I just, if this is current and existing law, then there's a problem with the current and existing law. And you know, our foundation for going after this needs to be rechecked, looked at again. If we're guilty until we're proven innocent, if a commissioner simply determines, if the commissioner simply determines that, hey, you know what, this farm out here, I want them investigated, and away we go, and we go and investigate them, and they get slapped with $20,000 in fees, we have a serious issue here. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from members? Representative Johnson, and then Representative Scott, and then members, we're going to see if there's any other testimony in the audience, and then we're going to move on. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, I take it this bill was brought forward by DNR as a department issue bill?
It was brought.
Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. This was brought forth by the DNR at the request of the Environmental Natural Policy and Finance Committees, because we know that additional tools are needed, and we want to make sure that they have the tools to make sure they're protecting our water resources in a fair and equitable way for everybody.
Representative Johnson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Fiona, thank you for clarifying who's bringing this bill forward. Have you talked to any of the other groups that this could be impacted by, such as the Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, and got their opinion on this information? Because I talked to them last night, the Farm Bureau, and they were not even aware of this. And it makes me wonder why this bill is rushing through so quickly, since it was just entered on Monday, and this is the second committee that I've heard this on. And I'm just wondering what's the need is to rush this through so quickly.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson. The reason there's a need for it is we have in several areas, we've got water management areas that have been declared because we don't have enough water in those areas, and we have issues that are occurring. Groups that I've already been working with, and I apologize for not talking to the Farm Bureau, I've been working with our local chamber, I've also been working with the League of Cities on these issues. And it comes down to a matter of fairness. As one of the things that we're finding is that the people that are violating the permits the most are making it very hard for those who are working and following the permits in a fair way. It's making sure that one business isn't taking advantage of another business, and that's what's happening in some areas, is you're finding that most people and most businesses and most communities are following the policies that are out there, but they get very disturbed when they find out that people can violate and there's not much of a penalty that comes in. So it comes down to a fairness issue, and I've been hearing that from the business community, I've been hearing it from our local cities and counties in the East Metro area. And so what we're trying to do is make sure we address this, and it is an urgent matter because we do have the waters that are the levels have gone down to where they're impacting natural resources in the area. White Bear Lake, which is the third largest lake in the metropolitan area, has lost over 40% of its volume in the last 10 years.
Representative Johnson, then Representative Scott, and then we're going to see if there's anyone in the audience who wants to testify on the bill, and then we're going to try to wrap this up. So Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, or can you tell me what the current statute, what the maximum fine is in the statute right now for violation of this?
I think $50 to $750.
Yes,
Ms. Ekman.
It's actually a bail schedule for a county. The process that we have currently, this would be these violators would be committing a misdemeanor. And the levies of the fines ranges from $50 to $750 currently.
Representative Johnson.
That wasn't actually what they're giving. I was wondering what the actual maximum fine is that allowable by law.
Ms. Ekman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Currently, if we issue, there was a current example that happened recently where we issued tickets to a violator who paid $300, and then he got another ticket. He paid $300 again. He ended up paying $3,100. I mean, this is an example of somebody who is just not taking the law seriously and deciding that they have so much to gain by using groundwater, which is a public resource, for their own private profit, that they would prefer to just pay the fine than to come into compliance with the law.
Representative Johnson.
I personally, myself, being in law enforcement for a number of years, been through the court systems. Unfortunately, we have what's called the bail schedule, and it depicts the fine, which is a lot of times much less than what the actual maximum fine could be. I also have a great concern when we start doing administrative penalties, because that bypasses our court system. It bypasses the person to appear before a judge. I see you do have administrative judge for appeals process, but I got a big problem when the commissioner can be the judge, jury, and executioner all at the same time. And that's what administrative fees, this bill does. Let's the commissioner be the judge, jury, and the executioner. A lot of these businesses, if they get a $20,000 fine, they're out of business. The employees no longer have a job. It affects us greatly. Yes, do we have an issue with the water? Absolutely. White Bear Lake has been an issue for years. I think we finally may have found out what the problem is. Maybe the city of White Bear Lake shouldn't be taking the water out for the community. Maybe they should have had a well instead of drawing the water straight out of the lake.
All right, members, I just want to make it really clear that if we don't finish the agenda, we're going to come back tonight. We're going to keep going today until we finish the agenda. So, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a fiscal note on this? Has one been requested?
There's no fiscal note at this point. There will be one by the time we get to the end.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Any ideas on how many FTEs this will add to the DNR?
Ms. Ekman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we don't see that we would need to add FTEs to administer this.
Okay. And
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, Representative Fisher, let's say that, well, first of all, couldn't this apply to homeowners as well? Couldn't they be fined?
Representative Fisher.
I think in terms when we're taking a look at this, and I would have to talk to my folks from the DNR here, is that in terms this is appropriations, and the DNR does not do any appropriations of water allocations to private homeowners.
Is that Scott. Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you 100% sure of that?
I am 100% sure of that. I haven't talked to the DNR folks yesterday. They said that in terms of local homeowners, that they do not do any appropriations at this point in time to any homeowners.
Representative All right. Scott.
All right. Thank you.
Further questions from members? Representative Uroso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in terms of the timing of this, beginning last year, I live in one of the proposed water management areas, and the DNR has been out to the area multiple times. There have been multiple hearings. It's been brought. All of this has been brought up in the Clean Water Council. So this is one of those emerging issues that requires some urgency and action, because it's becoming increasingly clear that these issues are not creeping slowly. They're rushing up upon us and are going to become critical if we don't do something about it. And in terms of the individual wells, drinking water comes first in the priority list, and one of the purposes of the appropriations is to make sure that those other uses don't interfere with drinking water.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill?
All right. Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call on this.
Representative Scott requests a roll call, and Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, the folks that I've talked to in my area, they don't deny that we need to go after and increase the penalties for those folks or be more effective on how we penalize the violators. I guess, you know, coming from an enforcement background, you know, on every day is a... We could change this, the current process, to where every day could be a new violation, and probably is today, which means every day could be a $750 fine and 90 days in jail. If we're not being effective on throwing some of these, go spend a few days in jail, I think it would be a wake-up call to these violators that they probably wouldn't do it anymore. But I do believe that that's what a misdemeanor offense is, and I think we can be effective if we start feeding them through a tray, through a little steel door a couple of times. They'd also all of a sudden get a wake-up call and probably not violate it anymore. I'm concerned that we're going to be the same place we are with MPCA, where we swing the hammer to drive, we swing a 16-pound sledge to drive a finishing nail. And that's what I'm concerned we're doing with this administrative penalty order. So I'm concerned about that. I think there's other avenues to take before we do this. I'm not saying that we don't need to be more effective on the violators, but we've got a lot of, DNR's got a lot of irons in the fire right now with water, and we all met last Friday, and we're still working trying to figure that one out. And I'm concerned that that's a statewide issue also. I don't believe that you're ready for this. Thank you.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fisher, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I'm going to take a slightly different tact. As someone who works in finance, I do believe that water is going to be the number one commodity going forward, and we need to protect it at all costs. And so I would appreciate you working with everybody as you take the bill forward, but I think it's a very good start. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Yarusso renews her motion that House File 2616 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resource Policy. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Elwin.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Hellstrom.
Yes.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Portman.
Aye.
Representative Howe.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Neuberger.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Pugh.
No.
Representative Rosenthal.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Yarusso.
Yes.
Eight in favor, seven opposed. The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Next bill. The next bill on the calendar is Representative Dean. Representative Dean, are you in the room? Welcome, Representative Dean. At this point, I will move that Representative Dean's bill, House File 1941, be re-referred to the Government Operations Committee. Representative Dean, keep in mind this is the Civil Law Committee, and try to keep your comments to the portions of the bill that apply just to this committee. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. There's also an amendment, A1.
All right. The chair moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Dean, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For those of you who aren't familiar with the bill, the bill is, I would say, a continuation to address some of the issues around foreclosure that have been part of our economy and our state for the last several years. This bill would allow the opportunity for an individual to go through mediation as the final process that they could participate in prior to the foreclosure of their house. It requires the banks prior to foreclosure to receive an affidavit of good faith, so participation in the mediation with good faith prior to actually proceeding with that foreclosure. Currently, we've made some modifications to 1941 that now incorporates the Minnesota Home Ownership Center, which is a counseling group that now is part of the process. So they, along with the banks, along with the Office of Administrative Hearing, will actually be working jointly to move the homeowner forward prior to that mediation. So I have a couple of testifiers I'd like to bring forward, and we'll take questions after that. So Sarah Larson is a homeowner that's been affected.
Thank you. Representative Dean, just so you know, the committee is supposed to adjourn in about 15 minutes, and if we don't complete the bill, we'll be coming back at 7 p.m. tonight. Representative Dean.
We will try to get done in 15 minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Sarah Larson, and I come to you today as a homeowner, but also as a small business owner, as a member of our local Chamber of Commerce, as the treasurer of the Waverly Economic Development Authority, as a registered nurse, as an Army veteran, as mother of four. We purchased our home in 2004 prior to the foreclosure crisis. And 90 days prior to our closing on our loan, we got an authorization or a pre-approval letter to get a VA loan. We were told 3 days prior to our closing that our loan had fallen through, but that they could put us into a ARM loan for a three-year ARM, and that after that, if we had proven our credit, that we'd be able to refinance. Unfortunately, the economy turned in a way that nobody may have foreseen, and our home lost incredible value. So our home that was valued at $246,000 is now valued at about $133,000. Those numbers are increasing, however, extremely slowly. My mortgage lender is HSBC Mortgage Services, and they have raised my interest rate increasingly over the last several years. My home, which is a modest single-family home in Waverly, my payment is roughly $2,000 to $2,200, depending on how my property taxes change with the escrow. $2,200 is a very large amount of money for a single-family home valued at $133,000. What makes my payment so high is the interest rate. The interest rate, because of the ARM, is anywhere between 7 and 8%. They raise it. They change it between that amount, but it doesn't change from there. I have tried to work since 2008 with HSBC to refinance our loan. We went at one point, there was a homeownership group. All the mortgagers came from across the country to meet with homeowners in St. Paul. We attended that. At that meeting, we were told that they would modify our loan, and if we made payments for 12 months, that they would refinance us. We did so, and the person who was our contact once we completed the 12 months had left the company, and I was bounced between call center rep to call center rep, most of which were not in the United States. So agent number 3467 would take my phone call and refer me to somebody else who would call me back or would tell me that I could apply for a modification. I have worked on this now for 6 years. I continue to pay this payment, although it means for my family that I have to decide what gets paid each month. I have taken forbearances on my student loans so that I can afford to pay this payment, hoping that I will be able to reach the mortgage company at some point and get them to reconsider. I formally sent them a letter requesting that they modify our loan down to 6%, which, given the current interest rates, I think is more than fair, and they have refused. They will not deal with me. They will not talk to me. I feel that this bill would give us an opportunity to speak face-to-face with somebody that had authority to make a decision in the case versus talking to an agent who has no authority, who is basically a customer service representative. And so that's, I would ask you to consider approving this.
Representing.
Well, and if I could speak to that, Madam Chair. And
to consider approving this.
Representing.
Well, and if I could speak to that, Madam Chair and committee members, there's talk that the foreclosure crisis is over, and now with the CFPB rules that everything is fine, and that, you know, the banks are working with everybody and all those things. And I think Ms. Larson's testimony shows that we are still in really difficult situations, and that we still do have bad actors out there that need to have rules in place, so that if they got to a situation with her where they foreclose, she would at least have the opportunity at that point to go through mediation prior to them being able to foreclose on her home. I'm assuming that she's, you know, one medical incident away, possibly, you know, she could lose her job, and her house would be in danger right now. And she, as she testified, she's been working on this for 6 years with a bank that's been unresponsive. So.
Thank you, Representative. Any further testifiers?
Yes, I have one more testifier, and I will make sure that he is done in 2 minutes. Mike Davey.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
2 minutes.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Mike Davey. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am an attorney in private practice, so I took time out of my schedule today to come down here to encourage all of you to support this bill. Much of my practice is helping people find relief when they find themselves in financial distress, so I help people file bankruptcy. A lot of times I help people file bankruptcy because they've lost a home to foreclosure. I've had clients come to me. I'm going to talk about one, Arnie. He didn't need to file bankruptcy. He didn't ask to lose his home. He didn't ask to become unemployed and lose his $52,000 a year job and be out of work for 18 months, liquidate his life savings to try and keep his mortgage current. And at the end of that, realize, I don't have a penny left. I've liquidated my life savings to try and save this house. He falls on hard times, and his mortgage company sends him a letter dated April 2nd, 2013. Your client says, Dear Arnold Nelson, thank you for recently contacting our office to discuss the above referenced loan. In our current economy, we understand and sympathize with families who may be experiencing unfortunate difficulties. The letter goes on to say, fill out one of these things, and I'm sure a lot of you've gotten calls as legislators, filled out the request for modification assistance packet, 7 or 8 pages long. Completed that about a month later. He then got a letter from them in June saying we need additional documentation in order to process your request for a loan modification. He kind of went back and forth in that paperwork process, and the paperwork got lost. They then sent him a letter saying the request for a modification has been declined by the MIC, the investor or master servicer of your loan. They have not provided us, the servicer, authority to modify your loan. So what does this bill do? I think just in simple terms, this bill gets the homeowner and the other entity in the room together, the entity being the lender, gets both parties who together have the power to resolve the situation and work on a modification rather than having to go through a third party that goes... Hands are tied. We don't have authority to modify your loan. This bill, this individual who was now working, he simply needed his loan re-aged. He wasn't asking for a principal reduction. He wasn't asking for anything insanely fancy. You know, he got his loan about 3 years ago. He's a veteran, and they said, you know what, we work with vets. We specialize in working with vets, and we know sometimes vets fall on hard times, and here's why you should get a loan with us. Because we will be there with you when you fall in those hard times. We have options available to you. But in this particular case, it certainly looks like there weren't options available. And I want to conclude by saying, you know, across the river in Wisconsin, I have a client. I recently filed a case for her. They have a mediation program in Wisconsin. She went through the process with Bank of America, refilled the paperwork out. This is in late 2013, so it was well after the time when a lot of people were saying, well, that paperwork problems, those have all been fixed. Well, they weren't resolved. She went back and forth, recompleted the paperwork multiple times, and eventually said, let's just try this mediation stuff. Bank of America agreed, and now she's working. She's negotiating with someone that has the power to say yes or no. And these discussions have been quite fruitful, and it looks like she's going to be able to save her house. And so I would just encourage all of you to consider, you know, our neighbor just to the east has a modification, a mediation program, and it's working for people there, and I think it can work here in the state of Minnesota. So I know we're needed to be brief, so I'll wrap up. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come down. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, that does legal advocacy and public policy. R&R Family Centers, that does shelters, transitional and permanent housing and services and development, and APAC, the Housing Consortium. I have 50 years of experience in housing and development, 26 years of legal advocacy, and many years of other experience, and have been a corporate auditor for Fortune 500 companies. I've also had more certifications than the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Minnesota Homeownership Center requires. I'll try and be short and sweet. Well, people will agree I'm short, maybe not so sweet. NeighborWorks America was created by Congress to be a training arm for HUD, and their curriculum is the basis of which all certified counselors and educators nationally, including those in Minnesota and the Home Ownership Center uses. Nonprofits who are not members of the Home Ownership Center must pay for sending their people out of state for NeighborWorks America certification. NeighborWorks America provides free training, but the smaller nonprofits have and others have to pay for travel and other expenses. When NeighborWorks America comes to Minnesota, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and the Home Ownership Center have limited certification training for only those who are in the Home Ownership Network. And so that means that the large organizations are getting free training and certification. Now, not all counselors and educators are in the Home Ownership Network. And so to direct consumers to only go to them is taking away clients from other organizations, besides violating what we consider the federal antitrust law that protects consumers and businesses. So it's like telling people only go to Wells Fargo and don't go to Bremer Bank, TCF, or any of the other banks or credit unions or financial institutions. And so we do work with the financial institutions and legal professionals that are being used here. And we also have our own components in supplementing NeighborWorks America, where we have been successful with all our clients. Also, some of the clients have not had bank mortgages and have gone through the foreclosure process or were at risk of foreclosure. So we worked with the attorneys or within our own trainings to handle that. Now, before Senator Moa left and Senator Scheid passed away, they were working on solutions to the barriers, disparities, and problems beyond this in the policies, the rulemaking, and the practices. Now, I'm addressing, as you can say, the amendment. Emerging HUD-approved agencies require certified counselors to practice 1 year before they do the application process, which adds on other time. And they also require a certain quota of clients. So, and as I understand, the Home Ownership Center just recently became a HUD-approved agency.
I'm going to need you to wrap up 1 minute.
1 minute, okay. The solutions are therefore to include other certified counselors who are outside the Minnesota Home Ownership Network, or to ask that Minnesota Homeownership include all certified counselors of NeighborWorks who have been certified by NeighborWorks America as part of this counseling referral system and membership. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill, please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm Kevin Dunleavy, and I'm from the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. I conceived, wrote, or edited most of the foreclosure amelioration legislation that was passed in the 2008, 2009, and 2010 sessions at the height of the foreclosure crisis. I got the President's Award from the Bar Association for 500 pro bono hours. I was the only person in the room that understood the process back then, and that may be the case again today. The foreclosure counseling system was set up as a bipartisan consensus during the initial stages of the foreclosure process. Many of its successes were my ideas, like sending the default letter to the counselor so that they could get involved with the debtors before delinquent payments, attorney's fees, and foreclosure expenses got added on to the debt. But it isn't pride of authorship that makes me question the wisdom of eliminating a working process reached through consensus for an untried process that doesn't have consensus. There are title problems and technical problems that need to be fixed, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on those today. I'm going to talk about the big issues, and they are constitutional problems with this legislation. The unbalanced nature of the legislation is a due process, equal protection concern. Neutrality is a key element in determining constitutionality, and the subjective good faith standard applies only to the creditors is ambiguous and may be void for vagueness. This is in contrast with the Farmer Lender Mediation Act, which a lot of this act is taken from, which has clear bullet points for if this, this, and this is done, it's good faith. If this, this, and this isn't done, it's bad faith. It's not a reasonableness standard left up to an administrative law judge. Justice should be blind and impartial, and the scale should be balanced. What we've got here is a hammer on one side and a feather on the other. Avoiding junior creditors' voluntary liens is a violation of the constitutional prohibition against impairment of contracts. The bill doesn't distinguish between voluntary and involuntary junior liens, and federal tax liens cannot be eliminated by state law under the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Allowing unlicensed advocates to represent debtors at mediation is an unauthorized practice of law. I don't view the present foreclosure counseling system as unauthorized practice of law. They're not representing the debtors at a tribunal. They're having direct contact with the debtors and with the creditors. In addition, the foreclosure counselors have gone through a governmental approval and screening process, like realtors, attorneys, mortgage brokers, and title agents. There's no approval process for the advocates to appear before administrative law judges. This is the unauthorized practice of law, and for that reason alone, this legislation should be rejected. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Please go ahead. Please limit your testimony to, you know, a few minutes.
My name is Julie Guggen. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Homeownership Center. We lead a network of 25 foreclosure prevention counseling agencies around the state. At the risk of going too far afield from our testimony, I'd like to just first refute what Ms. Lee testified to. She is a complete fabrication about the work of our organization and the extent of our organization. Having said that, related to this bill, our primary concerns about this bill are that it eliminates the pre-foreclosure notice, a revolutionary tool for reaching consumers early in the process, optimizing the potential for their success in foreclosure prevention counseling. It inserts foreclosure counselors in the mediation process in an ineffective and awkward way, and it fails to fully capitalize on the nation's best foreclosure prevention counseling network by not requiring foreclosure prevention counseling prior to the mediation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience wanting to testify for or against this bill, please come forward, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. We represent about 95% of the banks across Minnesota, from the very largest to the very smallest. We're testifying in opposition to this bill. Since 2007, we've worked collaboratively with stakeholders to pass 29 different bills with 91 different provisions to strengthen foreclosure laws in Minnesota. This is the first time we've actually had to outright oppose a foreclosure bill since then. Our members have numerous concerns with the bill, but we want to focus on those most relevant to the committee. First, as is mentioned, the bill's lack of constitutionality. If a mediator makes the subjective determination, and they are subjective factors, that the foreclosing entity or a subsequent lien holder is not acting in good faith, the foreclosing entity can't foreclose for at least another year, and the subsequent lien holder's lien will actually be voided. So that will violate Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution, saying that no state shall enter into any law impairing the obligation of contracts. The Minnesota Constitution also says that no law impairing the obligation of contracts shall be passed. We believe that voiding the subsequent lien is an unlawful impairment of contract under both constitutions. Further, both the 5th and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution provide that where a person, including a corporation, is facing a deprivation of property, like a subsequent lien holder would in this case, procedural due process mandates an adequate notice, hearing, and a neutral judge. But in the bill, the mediator, who may or may not be an expert in mortgages and foreclosures, must make the determination based on subjective factors as to whether the foreclosing entity and subsequent lien holder are acting in good faith. There's no opportunity for those entities to get a hearing or to appeal this subjective decision before their rights are taken. We believe this is a violation of the constitutional right to due process, and there is no question that legal challenges will follow the first takings by the state. Finally, we believe this bill compromises the foreclosure counseling system, a highly respected, effective, and efficient system, replacing trained experts and advocates with untrained neutrals. The bill does not require mediators to have expertise or provide for any training, but it does give the Office of Administrative Hearings the authority to write regulations implementing the law without having to comply with rulemaking safeguards in Chapter 14 of the Minnesota statutes. So there will be no public hearing, no opportunity to comment, and no opportunity to appeal those rules.
One more minute.
Mm-hmm. The MBA has come to the table year after year to work collaboratively with legislators and other stakeholders to improve Minnesota's foreclosure laws. We now have some of the most consumer-friendly foreclosure laws in the nation, as well as one of the finest foreclosure counseling programs in the nation. We think it's time to step back and give these laws and programs time to work. It was mentioned that there are new laws that are not working. Well, those laws were effective January 10th. So it is not fair to say that those laws are not working. This bill raises serious constitutional issues as well as marketability of title issues that have the potential to disrupt the real estate market. And we think it's this committee's purview to address these serious legal issues before referring it on to the next committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill, please come forward, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Mara Humphrey. I'm the Vice President of Governmental Affairs of the Minnesota Credit Union Network. Coming before you today, the Minnesota Credit Union Network and Minnesota Credit Unions have worked hard over the past 7 years to create a strong foreclosure process in Minnesota. We want to make sure everyone is due process as they're going through the foreclosure process. And we want to make sure that they have an equitable and fair method of going through the foreclosure process. We've sat down with the chair. We've appreciated the opportunity to sit down with him and work on the bill. But unfortunately, every version of this bill that we've seen has gotten worse for credit unions and small financial institutions. I won't belabor the point, but just want to say at this point, credit unions are opposed to this bill. Again, I think this is the first foreclosure bill we've just outright come out and been opposed to. A couple of the issues that have been mentioned is just the timing. We've worked so hard to make a strong foreclosure process in terms of notices, and the counseling process is something that I think has been working well, and we don't want to basically throw the baby out with the bathwater as we're revising the system, creating new notices, getting rid of things that aren't working. We don't want to start over, and definitely concerned that counseling is mitigated in this bill. We're also concerned with the small financial institution exemption. I think the intent is right on, that maybe the small financial institutions aren't the problem. I haven't heard about people walking into their local credit union and not having someone to talk to. They were right there. We're on your corner. You can walk in and get that. Right now, it only exempts financial institutions who have 125 or fewer filing notices in a year. It keeps getting smaller, started out at 150, and it only exempts loans that are held in portfolio, which a lot of smaller financial institutions, that is how they're able to offer mortgage loans, is by selling them on the secondary market, doing Fannie Freddie loans, FHA loans, and definitely have strong concerns about the impact that's going to have on our smaller financial institutions. I think the second lien holder issue was mentioned as well. It's going to be a huge burden to have every second lien holder come in to mortgage mediation in terms of the mechanics, and definitely have concerns about the constitutionality of the ability to just say, you didn't show up in good faith and that lien is no longer valid. So happy to stand for any questions, but the Minnesota Credit Union Network is opposed to this bill. We have definite concerns about how this process will work and how it's going to impact the foreclosure process. Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think we have the last testifier. Mr. Skillbred, come to the table. State your name for the record. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, David Skillbred, Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Try to mention a few things that have not been mentioned thus far.
Thank you.
Technical issues were addressed. Just a couple of specific ones. Lines 1.22 refers to the notice of sale being recorded. Notices of sale are not recorded. They are published and served upon the homeowner. Page 2.26 to 2.28. This is current law from a bill passed in 2013. Representative Hortman was the author of that bill. A very good consumer protection bill amongst all the others that we've done in the past few years. So I'm not sure why it's duplicated in this bill. Mediation requires two parties to give something up to a compromise. Farmers have a lot of assets, and they therefore can be used in that mediation process. Homeowners are typically W-2 employees, and the three biggest causes of foreclosure are loss of job, illness, and divorce. It's questionable how that will help those individuals. In a previous committee, proponents handed out a copy of an article from the Oregonian stating that U.S. Bank was participating in mediation and that it was working. If you read further down in the article, however, it says that as of the date of this article, 6 mediation sessions had been completed, 2 by U.S. Bank, 1 by Capital One Bank, and the rest by home loan state agency programs. Not really a powerful endorsement. The Independent Community Bankers oppose the bill. We're happy to work with our members and customers. All they got to do is walk in the door. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Dean, if I could just make one comment. I actually carried the homeowner lender mediation bill for 2 years and got it to the governor's desk. And I want you to know that there was always a parade of folks who were opposed to that proposal. And Representative Dean, if you promise that you will work with stakeholders to try to alleviate some of these issues, I'm willing to vote for your proposal for you to continue to work on it. It took forever, and ultimately then the governor vetoed the bill, even though we worked very hard. But if you will make a commitment that you will work with stakeholders in an attempt to alleviate some of their concerns, I know that you will have the ability to get folks to come to the table better. Representative Dean.
And Madam Chair and members, I have been working with the advocates on both sides of this issue for several months now. Several of the things that were cited here today have been resolved within the different iterations of the bill as well as the current amendment. I'm committed to continue to work with these individuals. You may have seen a letter. I've received a letter that they're in opposition, and I hope that their opposition doesn't mean that they're not willing to continue to come to the table to try to resolve these issues so that this is a good bill for Minnesota homeowners.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know we're pinched for time here, but Representative Dean, this is a chart of the current foreclosure process mm-hmm. in Minnesota. Look at that chart.
Yep.
It's crazy. So you're committed to working with all these parties. Are you also committed to upholding the Constitution? We took an oath for that.
Representative Dean.
Absolutely. Yes, Madam Chair.
Because I believe the testifiers, thank you, Madam Chair, I believe the testifiers today made it clear that this is an unconstitutional bill. It's unconstitutional. And so I'm willing to go ahead and take the vote on this without asking questions so we can get out of here by 10, but I would like to roll call it, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Liebling, and then Representative Rosenthal, and then we're going
to
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, I just have to say that, you know, I do think that legislators all have a duty to interpret the Constitution and uphold the Constitution. I think that's our basic duty. But, you know, if we're going to start throwing at each other that I don't think this is constitutional and that means you're not upholding, and I think we're opening a really bad can of worms there, and I'd just like us all to sort of take a deep breath and back off from that. We all have that duty, and we're all going to do that as we understand that duty. And I just don't want us to go there, because that's a rock that can be thrown around a lot in this body, and I just don't want us to start doing that.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean. Actually, I have a question for the testifier from the Bar Association. My concern is we've been working on this issue for years. There was a bill last year that had many, many problems. This bill seems to bring those problems back up again, and nothing seems to be solved. So, like Representative Hillstrom, I need your absolute confidence that you will not only work with all the stakeholders, but take into account what happened last year and work with people who were in the room and understand the process.
Mr.
And this question is for the testifier. Could you explain one more time your feelings on the bills, the part of the bill that you feel might be unconstitutional?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, Representative Blumenthal, the problems that I have with the bill, this is unlike the previous bills that Senator Scheid and Representative Hillstrom had in previous sessions. That was a more balanced bill. This is unbalanced. There's only a possibility of finding a bad faith by the creditor. There's no standards for it. It's subjective. It's a reasonableness standard, so there's the problem with void for vagueness and ambiguity. How do you know whether or not you're acting in good faith? It's an arbitrary decision. Under farmer lender mediation, there were check boxes. If you did these things, you acted in good faith. If you didn't, and it was for the creditor and the debtor. There's nothing here for the debtor. It's all about the creditor acting in good faith. The good faith standard has been added to the bill, I think, in the last iteration, because there wasn't one at all for the debtor. But there's no benchmark. There's no guidance as to what good faith is. But the unbalanced nature, that's an equal protection due process. It's just patently unfair the way this bill is not neutral.
Thank you. Actually, we actually have to wrap up so that Representative Paymar's committee can start right now. So, Representative Rosenthal, you got one more comment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean, I'm going to reluctantly vote to move this bill forward, but I expect you to work with stakeholders and come to agreement that is more balanced.
The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Hellstrom?
Aye.
Representative Allen?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Holbrook?
No.
Representative Hortman?
Aye.
Representative Howe?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Neuberger?
No.
Representative Paymar?
Aye.
Representative Pugh?
No.
Representative Rosenthal?
Aye.
Representative Simon?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Aye.
Representative Yarusso?
Aye.
The bill passes 9-7. Thank you, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
With that, this meeting is adjourned.
I agree with you.